fruit of prayer is faith. The fruit of faith is love. The fruit of love is service. The fruit of service is peace. Now you remember that I mentioned that anyone who has really made a difference for good or ill in the world possessed three common attributes: vision, discipline, and passion. Now consider another leader who possessed all three, but produced shockingly different results. Adolf Hitler passionately communicated his vision of a thousand-year reign of the Third Reich and of a superior Aryan race. He built one of the most disciplined military-industrial machines the world has ever seen, and he evidenced brilliant emotional intelligence in his impassioned oratory, inspiring in the masses almost fanatical dedication and fear, which he channeled into hate and destruction. There is, however, a huge difference between leadership that works and leadership that endures. Every one of the aforementioned leaders laid a foundation and provided a contribution that endured, except for one. Adolf Hitler, who once said, "Once I am really in power, my first and foremost task will be the annihilation of the Jews." When conscience governs vision, discipline, and passion, leadership endures and changes the world for good. In other words, moral authority makes formal authority work and endure. When conscience does not govern vision, discipline, and passion, leadership does not endure, nor do the institutions created by that leadership endure. In other words, formal authority without moral authority ultimately fails. When we say that when conscience governs vision, discipline, and passion, leadership endures and changes the world for good means that it lifts and also that it lasts. Hitler had vision, discipline, and passion, but was driven by ego. Lack of conscience was his downfall. Gandhi's vision, discipline, and passion were driven by conscience, and he became a servant to the cause and to the people. Again, he only had moral authority, no formal authority, and he was the father and founder of the second largest country in the world and the largest democracy. When vision, discipline, and passion are governed by formal authority void of conscience or moral authority, it also changes the world, but not for good, rather for evil. Instead of lifting, it destroys. Rather than lasting, it is eventually extinguished. Now let's look at conscience, which is the most significant of these great four capacities, these virtues. George Washington once said, "Labor to keep alive that little spark of celestial fire, conscience." Much has been said from the outset of this book about the singular importance of conscience. There is a mass of evidence that shows that conscience, this moral sense, this inner light, is a universal phenomenon. The spiritual or moral nature of people is also independent of religion or of any particular religious approach, culture, geography, nationality, or race. Yet all of the enduring major religious traditions of the world are unified when it comes to certain basic underlying principles or values. Immanuel Kant said, "I am constantly amazed by two things, the starry heavens above and the moral law within." Conscience is the moral law within. It is the overlapping of moral law and behavior. Many believe, as do I, that it is the voice of God to his children. Others may not share this belief, but recognize that there is an innate sense of fairness and justice, an innate sense of right and wrong, of what is kind and what is unkind, of what contributes and what detracts, of what beautifies and what destroys, of what is true and what is false. Admittedly, culture translates this basic moral sense into different kinds of practices and words. But this translation does not negate the underlying sense of right and wrong. As I work in nations of different religions and different cultures, I have seen this universal conscience revealed time and again. There really is a common sense of values, a sense of fairness, honesty, respect, and contribution that transcends culture, something that is timeless, which transcends the ages and is also self-evident. Again, it is as self-evident as the fact that trust requires trustworthiness. Albert Schweitzer said, "In everyone's life, at some time, our inner fire goes out. It is then burst into flame by an encounter with another human being. We should all be thankful for those people who rekindle the inner spirit." Close quote. When I was a young man, I had an experience with a leader that profoundly shaped the rest of my life. I had decided to take a break in my education to give some extended volunteer service. The invitation came to go to England. Just 4 1/2 months after my arrival, the president of the organization came to me and said, "I have a new assignment for you. I want you to travel around the country and train local leaders." I was shocked. Who was I to train leaders 2 and 3 times my age? Sensing my doubt, he simply looked me in the eye and said, "I have great confidence in you. You can do this. I will give you materials to help you prepare to teach these leaders and to facilitate their sharing best practices with one another." His confidence, his ability to see more in me than I saw in myself, his willingness to entrust me with responsibility that would stretch me to my potential, literally unlocked something within me. I accepted the assignment and gave my best. It tapped me physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I grew. I saw others grow. I saw patterns and basic leadership principles. By the time I returned home after 2 years, I had begun to detect the work I wanted to devote my life to, unleashing human potential. I found my voice, and it was my leader that inspired me to find it. I realized in time that I wasn't the only one he treated this way. His affirmation of others, his ability to unite us in vision toward our work that inspired and motivated us, his pattern of providing us with enabling resources and empowering us as true leaders with accountability and stewardship became the norm in our entire organization. We began to lead and serve others in the same way, and the results were remarkable. I've realized since then that the principles that guided his leadership are common to great leadership in any organization, regardless of the level or formal position of the person. My teaching, consulting, and leadership experience in business, university, volunteer and church organizations, and especially in my own family, have taught me that leadership influence is governed by principles. When you live by them, your influence and moral authority increase, and you are often given even greater formal authority. The biblical parables of the pounds and of the talents illustrate that the more you use and magnify the gifts or talents you have been given, the more gifts and talents you are given. But if they are ignored or buried and remain undeveloped and unused, the very talents or gifts that you have been given will be lost and often given to another. So you end up not only losing talents, but also losing influence and opportunities. There is great power in the idea of taking responsibility and just doing it, making it happen. This highest level of initiative reminds me of a true story called A Message to Garcia, written by Albert Hubbard. Here is a brief summary. When the war broke out between Spain and the United States at the turn of the century, the American president needed to get a message to a Cuban revolutionary named Garcia. He was hiding somewhere on the island of Cuba out of reach of mail or telegraph. Nobody knew how to reach him, but an officer suggested that if anyone could do it, it would be an officer by the name of Rowan. When President McKinley gave the letter to Rowan in Washington, D.C., the officer didn't ask, "Where is he at? How do I get there? What do you want me to do when I'm there? How will I get back?" He just took the message and figured out how to get to Garcia. He took a train to New York, a ship to Jamaica, broke the Spanish blockade to get to Cuba in a sailboat, then wild carriage rides, marching and riding through the Cuban jungle. 9 days of traveling later, Rowan got the message to Garcia at 9 in the morning. That same afternoon at 5, he started his return journey to the United States. Giving further insight, author Albert Hubbard wrote, "My heart goes out to the man who does his work when his boss is away as well as when he is at home. The man who, when given a letter to Garcia, quietly takes the missive without asking any idiotic questions and with no lurking intention of chucking it into the nearest sewer or of doing aught else but deliver it. Civilization is one long, anxious search for just such individuals. Anything such a man asks will be granted. His kind is so rare that no employer can afford to let him go. He is wanted in every city, town, and village, in every office, shop, store, and factory. The world cries out for such. He is needed, and needed badly, the man who can carry a message to Garcia." You can see that no matter what issue, problem, or concern you have, you can empower yourself by taking initiative in some way. Be sensitive, be wise, be careful regarding time, but do something about the situation. Avoid complaining, criticizing, or being negative. Be especially wary of absolving yourself from responsibility and simply blaming them for failures. We live in a culture of blame. A full 70% of XQ respondents see that people in their organization tend to blame others when things go wrong. So taking responsibility will mean swimming against the cultural current. Taking initiative requires vision, some standard to be met, or some improvement to be achieved. It requires discipline in the doing. It requires getting your heart and your passion into it, and doing it in a conscience-directed or principled way toward a worthy end. Tom Peters describes the Trim Tab attitude and spirit this way. Winners, no kidding, adore crummy jobs. Why? Because those jobs allow lots and lots of space. Nobody cares. Nobody is watching. You're on your own. You are king. You can get your hands dirty, make mistakes, take risks, perform miracles. The most common lament of the unempowered is that they don't have the space to do anything cool, to which I unfailingly reply, rubbish. Bottom line, relish the little assignment or chore that no one else wants. Seek it out. It's a license for self-empowerment, whether it's the redesign of a form or planning a weekend client retreat. You can turn it into something grand and glorious and wow. Close quote. Once I served as the administrative assistant to the president of a university. In many ways, he was dictatorial, controlling, always assumed he knew what was best, and would make all the important decisions. On the other hand, he was a visionary, a brilliant, talented person. But he treated everyone like a gopher. Go for this, go for that. As if they didn't have a mind. These highly educated, motivated men and women gradually became disenchanted and then disempowered. They would stand around the executive corridors complaining about the president. I can't believe what he did. You know, let me tell you the latest. Oh, you think that's bad. You ought to see what he did when he came into our department. Really? I'd never heard that. Yeah, I've been in a job where I've been so constricted and straitjacketed by all these foolish rules and this bureaucracy. It's bogging me down. You know, they'd spend hours massaging each other's hearts with such comments. Then there was Ben. He simply took another approach. He went straight to the third level of empowerment and initiative. Even though he, too, was treated like a gopher, he decided to start at the make a recommendation level. He decided to be the best gopher around. This earned him credibility, ethos. He would then anticipate the president's needs and the reasons behind the gopher requests, ethos. He would say inside himself, now let's see. Why does the president want this information? I'll bet he's preparing for a board meeting and he wants me to gather data on how many university campus securities around the country carry sidearms, because he's getting criticized about our approach. I think I'll help him prepare for that board meeting. Ben came to a preliminary meeting, presented his gopher data, then went the second mile in analysis and recommendations. The president turned to me, speechless. Then he turned back to Ben and said, I want you to come to the board meeting and make the recommendation. Your analysis is brilliant. You anticipated exactly what the need is. Everyone else on the staff had bought into the silent conspiracy of wait until told. But not Ben. He exercised the initiative by empathizing with the president, by determining what it was he really wanted and needed. Ben started out with a relatively low position, but pretty soon he was regularly making presentations to the board. Logos. His motto was, compliment. Don't criticize your boss. Compliment, P-L-E. Compliment your boss. I worked in that role for 4 years. By the end of the fourth year, Ben was the second most influential person on the campus, even though he hadn't risen to the academic ranks. The president would not make any significant moves without Ben's blessing. When Ben retired, there was a special recognition award put in his name. Why? Because he modeled trustworthiness, loyalty to the university, and the willingness to do whatever it took, and the exercise of initiative and self-empowerment. I think Ben understood the futility of wishing for something to be different. Can you see in this story how leadership can become a choice? Can you see how you, too, can become the leader of your boss, as Ben did? So when we say that leadership is a choice, it basically means you can choose the level of initiative you want to exercise in response to this question. What is the best I can do under the circumstances? You will always need to make judgment calls regarding these 7 levels of initiative. It takes judgment and wisdom to know what level of initiative to exercise, what you should do, how you should do it, when you should do it, and perhaps most importantly, why you should do it. This will take all 4 intelligences. The why question usually taps into spiritual intelligence because it gets at your value system, the source of motivation. The what to do question usually taps into your intellectual intelligence as you think analytically, strategically, and conceptually. The when to do it and how to do it questions usually tap into your emotional intelligence as you read the environment, sense the cultural and political operating norms, and discern your own strengths and weaknesses. The doing intelligence will also come into play as you carry out your intentions and tactically implement the how. When you wisely use initiative through all 7 levels of initiative, you'll find that your circle of influence will get larger and larger until it encompasses your entire job. Interestingly, and this almost always happens, as your circle of influence enlarges, so too does your circle of concern. A trim tab leader is constant, like a lighthouse, not a weather vane, a constant, dependable source of light, not someone who twists and turns with every social wind. As you take this inside-out, initiative-seizing approach, people in formal positions will have increasing confidence in your character and competence. Trust will increase. It is almost inevitable that they will want to build higher and higher levels of initiative and empowerment into your job. You will find yourself becoming the leader of your boss, and your boss will naturally become part of a complementary team as servant leader. This book is primarily attempted to teach one basic paradigm, that people are whole people, body, mind, heart, and spirit. As a person engages in the sequential eighth habit process of finding or creating one's own voice, making the choice to expand his or her influence by inspiring others to find their voice, he or she increases his or her freedom and power of choice to solve his or her greatest challenges and to serve human needs. He or she learns how leadership can eventually become a choice, not a position, so that leadership, the enabling art, is widely distributed throughout organizations and society. And therefore, while we manage or control things, we lead or empower people. Regarding the people paradigm, we have learned that every human being is precious in his or her own right, endowed with enormous, almost infinite potential and capacity. We've learned that the pathway to enlarging that capacity is magnifying our present gifts and talents. Then, almost like a flower blooming in the spring, additional gifts and talents are given or opened up to us, and our hardwired capacities in all four areas are unleashed to lead a balanced, integrated, powerful life. The opposite is also the case, because if we neglect our gifts and talents, they, like the unused muscle, will atrophy and waste away. We've also learned that the culture we live and work in has softwared us for mediocrity, or in other words, to fall far short of our potential. Anything less than a whole person is a thing, and things have to be controlled or managed. This command and control industrial age software has driven the workplace to believe that the greatest source of wealth lies in capital and equipment, not in people. We've also learned that we have the hardwired power to rewrite that software, and that this power inspires us to lead, to empower people who have the power of choice and to manage things which do not. The developmental process paradigm answers the how and when questions and teaches us to consider ourselves first by subordinating what we want now for what we want later. That's the essence of true happiness, subordinating what we want now for what we want later. This process is increasingly exciting because it is increasingly powerful in expanding our choices and our capacities. If we follow principles symbolized by a compass that always points north, we gradually develop moral authority. People trust us, and if we truly respect them and see their worth and potential and involve them, we can come to share a common vision. If through our moral authority, that is primary greatness, we can earn formal authority or position, that is secondary greatness, we can together institutionalize these principles so that body and spirit are being constantly nourished, leading to unbelievable kinds of freedom and power to expand and deepen our service. In short, the kind of leadership that inspires followership comes only when we put service above self. Organizations, both private and public, learn that they are only sustainable when they serve human needs. Again, service above self. This is the true DNA of success. It's not about what's in it for me, but about what can I contribute. It's like the anonymous verse, I sought my God, and my God I could not find. I sought my soul, and my soul eluded me. I sought my brother to serve him in his need, and I found all three, my God, my soul, and thee. Now let me just add a few final words. To you as a reader, I affirm both your worth and your potential. My sincere hope is that the principles in this book have been communicated clearly enough so that you not only have come to see your worth and potential in yourself, but that you will also find your voice and live a life of greatness by inspiring many other people and organizations and communities to find their voice. Even if you live in horrible circumstances, it is in those very circumstances that you will find your call to choose your own response. It is then that life calls out to us to serve those around us whose needs we become aware of. It is in so doing that we find our true voice in life.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to this special audio program of The Eighth Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness, and have gained new insights that will serve you and your organization. We look forward to hearing from you.
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.